You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 23rd of January 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello from Studio One here in London, and welcome to Midori House. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme, from a boardroom in Montreux to the streets of Cairo, we'll review the day's top stories with Jane Kinnamont and Raffaello Pantucci here in the studio. Then we pop over to the World Economic Forum in Davos, where Bloomberg's Matthew Campbell brings us the latest.
This very basic component of international business, of international thought, that people can live and work more or less where they wish, particularly highly skilled people, could be under threat.
And continuing a Swiss theme, Alexa Firmenich meets the founder of Zurich's Institute of Technology in Architecture.
The robots will also build the roof of this building in a factory. We'll build the roof out of small pieces of wood.
All that, plus a review of the latest literature releases in the Eastern Med, and plenty more besides, right here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Plenty to enjoy in the next hour then here on Midori House. Before we get started, let's hear from David Spencer, who's here with the latest world news.
Thank you, Monocle 24 News. I'm David Spencer. South Sudan's government and rebel troops have signed a ceasefire. Representatives of President Salva Kiir and members from Vice President Riek Machar's delegation signed the pact in the Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa after weeks of talks. It's hoped the deal will end fighting that has lasted more than a month and killed thousands of people in the world's newest nation. Opposition leaders in Ukraine have warned the president he must call immediate elections or risk further violence. Two people have died in confrontations with riot police this week, in the worst trouble so far in Kiev since protests began in November. Violence has now spread to other parts of the country. Viktor Yanukovych's government has said it's willing to compromise, but warned opponents not to set an ultimatum, while the prime minister has accused opponents of trying to stage a coup. The president of Iran has told the World Economic Forum in Davos that his country is determined to negotiate a comprehensive deal on its nuclear program so its economy can grow. Hassan Rouhani said Tehran was negotiating with the United States as part of a constructive engagement with the world and wanted Washington to back up its words with actions. He said Iran could become one of the top 10 economies in the world. US-Iranian artist Shirin Nishat is in Davos and praised his speech.
It was what I expected, a man who's trying to make peace with the world and invite people in and make economic, you know, progress. I just wish that he spoke not only about the world affairs, but his projections for the people of Iran and what his plans were in terms of what I was talking about, the identity crisis of the Iranian people.
Russia has urged other countries to ignore letters threatening an attack on next month's Winter Olympics in Sochi, dismissing the warnings as a hoax. The host nation echoed International Olympic officials, who said the messages received by National Olympic Committees in the United States and at least five European countries making a terrorist threat posed no danger. After two suicide bombings killed 34 people in the southern city of Volgograd last month, Russia has been keen to assure athletes and spectators that the Olympics in Sochi will be safe. In the United States, a federal privacy watchdog has said the National Security Agency's bulk collection of phone records provides only minimal benefits to countering terrorism, is illegal, and should end. The Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board is an independent government agency that advises the President and Congress on how to ensure that counterterrorism operations also protect Americans' privacy. The report could further complicate efforts by both President Barack Obama and Congress to come up with possible reforms to NSA eavesdropping programs, which have been under harsh scrutiny in the wake of revelations by former NSA contractor Edward Snowden. More than $500 million worth of drugs, cash and assets have been seized in a major anti-money laundering operation in Australia. Authorities in Sydney said it's disrupted 18 high-risk criminal syndicates and resulted in more than 100 arrests. The covert operation seized $580 million worth of drugs and assets. John Schmidt is chief executive of Australia's anti-money laundering regulator.
Money laundering is a global threat The only response we can have to it is working together both on the national basis and then with our equivalent colleagues overseas. The criminals don't recognise the borders. The money will flow. It is our job to do our best to prevent that.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, David. It's 5 minutes past 1800 hours here in London. You're listening to Midori House, and we'll be back after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. See on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 6 minutes past 1800 hours, 13:06 in New York City. I'm delighted to say that joining me now with their unique take on the news is Jane Kinnamont, Deputy Head and Senior Research Fellow in the Middle East and North Africa Programme at Chatham House, and Raffaello Pantucci, Senior Research Fellow at RUSI, the Royal United Services Institute here in London. Welcome both to the programme.
Thank you.
Oh, a nice upbeat tone of voice. I like it already.
Of course.
Amen. In the unison.
Let's start the discussion today in Montreux, where foreign ministers, diplomats and officials are squabbling, I think it's safe to say, over the fate of Syria, which is, of course, locked in the grip of this ongoing civil war. Jane, it's interesting. I mean, we've talked before about the difficulties with these kind of meetings and the difficulties in actually getting the kinds of discussions that are really needed to happen.
Yes.
Is this once again more about who's not there than who actually is?
Well, I think these kinds of meetings overseas are better suited to the interests of states than to something as complex and fragmented as the Syrian opposition. So you have got this big question about how representative the opposition delegation is. That's been one of the problems. But also this kind of bungle over the invite to Iran that was withdrawn at the last moment has cast rather a shadow over the talks.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, that's this kind of the elephant that's not in the room, isn't it, Raffaello, is this issue of Iran. Does it render the whole thing futile, or are there still actual, is there still progress that can be made despite of that?
I mean, I must say I'm even more sceptical in some ways than Jane was just hinting at. I think the fact that you're dealing with a set of talks where two of the most powerful actors on the ground in security terms are not represented makes me wonder what kind of a discussion are we really going to come to. And the fact that there's absolutely no ceding of position from the Assad side of his potential leaving or not, his stepping down. And that's a precondition that the other side has said, is something saying that this is the red line which we're not going to go, we're going to let you go beyond. It just all feels to me like we really aren't getting very far. I think Jane's 100% right. These sorts of scenarios are really better suited for, you know, state-on-state discussions. And so, you know, to some point, it's good that the Americans and the Russians are at least having a discussion about some of these things. And, you know, they're serious and important international players in this whole scenario. So them at least having a discussion means that there will be some benefit to this interaction. However, from my perspective, in terms of what's actually going to stop the fighting on the ground, I just don't think this is.
And does it provide an opportunity, you know, with the absence of Iran, does that mean that, you know, other actors who we allude to there, is it an opportunity then for them to sort of push their interests, or is it not a sort of black and white issue like that?
Well, the opposition delegation was very concerned about Iran attending. They thought that Iran attending would be a symbol that Iran was being accepted as legitimate. They would even caricature it as saying it meant that Iran was being given a green light to interfere in Syria. So certainly they'll be pleased that the invitation was withdrawn. But this is probably the start of a long process, and I would hope that there is some opportunity to bring in the Saudis and the Iranians, even if it's done through proxies or track two kind of add-ons to these larger scale talks that are in the media spotlight.
I want to ask you, Rafaela, about that idea of sort of proxies. I mean, how do you get those actors involved then? If I sort of said, right, Rafaela, you're in charge, everyone will do exactly what you tell them, what a great opportunity that would be. How would you make that happen? I mean, can there be track two? Does that actually work in practical terms?
Well, I mean, I think it's the way to start the discussion. You know, you do have to get, clearly these are very difficult situations, and you've got groups that have set themselves positions publicly from which they can't publicly withdraw unless the other side steps down as well. So yes, doing it through some sort of proxy discussion is, you know, a possibility, or finding a way of having a secret or quiet track 1.5 or whatever discussion is another way of doing it. We just saw this with Iran, though I think we'll probably come to whether this is actually moving in a positive direction or not. But, you know, the whole question of the US was having these discussions in Oman with the quite senior Iranian delegations, and that was done through, you know, senior State Department officials, meaning they count about. So it is possible to do these things. And yes, I think through proxies or through, you know, in quiet places which are maybe outside the media spotlight, it's possible to do it. And that does open doors and start a discussion. And then you set a mood. And then from that mood, people can publicly step back from things they've said in the past. But if you're going into a situation where everyone's drawn very hard red lines and no one's backing down from them, and the, you know, people who are really causing a lot of the violence on the ground aren't showing up to the talks, then it makes me wonder how much you're actually really going to achieve.
Oh, fairly bleak assessment, as always. I mean, I just wonder, Jane, do you think there is any real prospect then? It's all well and good saying, well, let's hope that these things come out of it and we can all have that aspiration. But there's that rather nagging feeling that this is all rather doomed from the outset. Is that too pessimistic?
I think it's hard to find anyone that's very optimistic about the talks. At the same time, there is a need for a political solution. It's rather a cliche to say it, but something has to be tried. But you know, how long is it going to take? Is really the question.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk a little bit more about some other news from Syria. Al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zawahiri has called on Islamists in the country to put an end to infighting, create a judicial committee to mediate differences. A new audio recording, which was released recently, sort of suggested, alluded to a lot of this. Again, a lot of sentiment, perhaps, to admire, and maybe some ideas to think, well, you know, that's something that could all be built towards. But what are the differences? What do we really understand about within these groups, what the problems are in terms of, is that just a pie in the sky idea?
Well, I think that there's sort of two stories that are coming out of this one. On the one hand, it's the infighting that we've seen on the rebel side in the past few months now, I suppose it is, between the ISIS or ISIL, depending on whose version you use, which is sort of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which has sort of spread and now transformed itself into sort of Al-Qaeda in Iraq and Syria. And then the original Al-Qaeda affiliate that was on the ground, Jabhat al-Nusra, and then all the many array of other rebel factions, be they everything from really quite hardline Islamists who frankly aren't that far away from Al-Qaeda in their sort of expression, all the way over to, you know, more sort of free FSA groups who will occasionally use sort of Islamist rhetoric. Anyway, this is the whole rebel side. Now, you know, but the two sort of big fighting groups that we've really seen is the Al-Qaeda's affiliate that came from Iraq, and then Jabhat al-Nusra, the more Syrian one. And what we're seeing Zawahiri here is trying to sort of mediate between this. He's tried to do this before, and it didn't work last time. Last time, he was frankly ignored. Jolani, the head of Jabhat al-Nusra, came out and sort of pledged allegiance to Zawahiri when the other al-Qaeda from Iraq tried to sort of claim his group and say, you're just a part of mine. And the other one instead rejected Zawahiri's last message. So, you know, I think what we're seeing here is we're seeing that the situation on the ground is very chaotic between the rarest rebel factions. But then also we're seeing Zawahiri's power, and this is something that we'd seen sort of increasingly, I would say, over what, the past year or so, maybe. Zawahiri has tried to assert himself over some of these regional Al-Qaeda affiliates who, you know, normally have said, we are part of Al-Qaeda's global movement, and it hasn't worked. And they frankly ignored him in some situations and gone ahead and done what they wanted to do anyway. We've seen a couple of them actually publicly sort of say, no, we're going to do something else. Others have just sort of done something else instead. So I think what we're seeing here is a sort of complicated picture of a fragmentation of Al-Qaeda, which is something we've been talking about a lot over the past few years, really. But it's really starting to happen and really starting to see the leadership. It doesn't necessarily have the control over its affiliates that it used to.
Well, I was going to ask about that. I mean, the kind of power or the traction that Zawahiri has then when he makes these kind of pronouncements. Is it more empty words then? Is it the same problem that he encounters that we've been talking about already? People simply won't pay any attention.
There will be some that respect him as someone that's got a lot of experience as a leader of this organization. But the jihadi groups in Syria, they're going to include a really diverse range of people. Often they're much more caught up in a local competition for arms and land. If they were really committed to Al-Qaeda goals, their focus would always be on attacking the Assad regime, attacking that secular, brutal regime. But instead, a lot of the fighting that is going on now is fighting within opposition groups, trying to get some territory, trying to take someone else's guns and so forth.
Rafael, just briefly, in terms of the sort of overriding structure then of Al-Qaeda, it's intriguing. I mean, what does it look like globally? You know, is it the sort of centralised? People speculate often about, you know, how it's made up and who really is pulling the strings. Is it completely decentralised? I mean, is there anyone who can actually exert the kind of influence that Zawahiri is trying to do?
Well, I mean, if anyone could, theoretically, it would be Zawahiri. And I think the fact that he's so notably failed to demonstrates the sort of loss of power that you've seen from the core. You know, when Osama bin Laden was still alive, I think he probably did still command that sort of respect and that sort of control, whereas he would determine what groups are doing. And you did see that, you know, when he was still around, the organization did have something of a more hierarchical structure and a more sort of direction about what it was trying to do. What we've seen since he's gone is that each of the various regional affiliates have started to focus much more locally, be that in sort of the Maghreb, where we've seen AQIM fracture in many different places as well, and all the different groups there have sort of shot off to do all sorts of different things, to what we're seeing in Syria, where we've got two competing Al-Qaeda affiliates fighting each other on the ground, to, you know, Somalia and Al-Shabaab, where we have an organization which seems to want to be more like sort of Al-Qaeda, but at the same time doesn't seem able to actually achieve it. To, you know, what we're seeing in Yemen, where we've got arguably, I would say, the last of the affiliates, which really, aside from what's left of the core in sort of Pakistan, which is still very much would listen to what the core sort of commands it to do. I think the other ones are very much starting to go in their old direction, which in a way is actually more disturbing and quite much more alarming, because then they use the rhetoric of Al-Qaeda and they will sort of attack the sorts of targets that they want to, but they won't necessarily do it in the same sort of coherent and clear fashion. And I think this is what you see when you see some of the attacks we've seen in Africa in particular against Western targets that are out there. That they're clearly targeting the Western target, but it's a more local target than, you know, trying to get an attack in the United States or Europe.
And consequently, I guess, becomes even more unpredictable as a consequence. Let's move on. We talked a little bit about the sort of botched invite to Iran. Let's talk a little bit about some of the figures involved, Ban Ki-moon in particular. Diplomats the world over puzzled, shall we say, after invited them to the meetings. And then, of course, rescinded to offer after a bit of an outcry. There's been a new article on Politico by Richard Gowan. Yes, Ban Ki-moon is America's poodle. He's not that impressed. His outreach to Iran was a rare display of courage and independent thinking. Nevertheless, rescinding the invite, he claims, appeared overzealous and amateurish. America's poodle, is that... Jane, would you join in that characterisation of Ban Ki-moon?
I think it's a bit harsh overall. I mean, I think this has obviously been really badly handled. I'm not sure the initial invite was so wildly independent in itself. I think there were many people, including Western diplomats, who wanted Iran to be at the talks, but they wanted to be clear that Iran accepted the results of the first lot of Geneva talks before going into the second round, and that would include accepting a transitional government that might not have Assad in it. Ban Ki-moon suggested that that assurance had been given privately, but that wasn't good enough. The withdrawal of the invitation is messy and does seem to reflect pressure from the US, but also the Gulf, especially Saudi Arabia.
I mean, Rafael, it's interesting, isn't it? Ban Ki-moon, he needs to be a kind of a political pragmatist as much as anything else. I mean, he surely needs to keep the US and to a lesser extent Saudis on side. It's just political pragmatism, isn't it? We shouldn't condemn him and his poodling ways too readily, should we?
Well, I think that the point in some ways that this article from Politico makes is that maybe there's a recognition, of course, if you're playing this sort of a figure, the UN Secretary General, it's a very delicate dance you have to do, because you do have to keep everyone happy and you're supposed to speak for, you know, the world, and that's a pretty big constituency with many different factions within it. But I suppose the point that the Politico article makes is that if we look and compare him to Kofi Annan seem more willing to take slightly more antagonistic is the wrong, but take positions which seem more focused on, you know, human rights or particular disaster that was happening on the ground. Whereas the impression one gets of Ban Ki-moon is that there's much more contemplation and focus on process and worrying about, well, okay, let's get something together, rather than saying a terrible thing's happening, we must draw a line here and there. Now, you know, what I would also say is it's interesting in this article is it does point out that Ban Ki-moon was one of the earlier people to highlight what was happening in Syria as a real slow-burning crisis that no one was really paying attention to. So maybe it's a little unfair to go so far as to call him America's poodle, but I think certainly he's a very different sort of Secretary General to maybe some of the ones we've seen in the past.
Well, he's certainly engaged in some different spats, or he's been forced to. There was one fairly entertaining, certainly rather widely watched, his run-in with Syria's foreign minister, Walid al-Mualem. Al-Mualem ignored Ban Ki-moon's appeal to end an opening speech that lasted over 30 minutes. Let's just listen to a little bit of this, and we can see some of the problems that poor Ban Ki-moon has to face up to.
Can you just wrap up? Because you have spoken only 20 minutes, longer than 20 minutes.
Mr. Secretary, you spoke 25 minutes. No. I came here after 12 hours in the aeroplane.
Yeah, I know you have a lot to speak.
Few minutes to end my speech.
Yeah.
This is Syria.
How much do you have left now?
I think 5-10 minutes.
Oh, no. It's not... Can you just, I will give you another, opportunity.
No, I
at
can't
the end,
divide my speech. This, I must continue.
You have already spoken.
I'll do my best to be.
Can you just wrap up in just 1 or 2 minutes?
No, I can't promise you. I must finish my speech.
Then I'll have to give
equal time
to the opposition group. So
yourself, please. You live in New York, I live in Syria. I have the right to give the Syrian version here in this forum.
Yes, of course, I
after
do not.
After 3 years of suffering,
that,
this is my right.
This, we have to have some constructive and harmonious dialogue.
I have
please refrain
you
from any inflammatory remarks and accusing some member state participating here, so which will not be constructive at this time.
It is constructive. I promise you to be constructive. Let me finish my speech.
Within 2 or 3 minutes, please.
Okay.
2 or 3 minutes, and I will give you another opportunity, okay?
Another 20 minutes, no?
Poor old Ban Ki-moon. I mean,
that was almost 20 minutes in itself.
But I just wonder, that does characterise some of the problems he faces, because sometimes these things descend into these slang matches. People are timing their watches like it's a timed game of chess. I mean, does he do as good a job as he possibly can do when confronted with people who are so obstinate often and so difficult to deal with? Or do you think that broadly you would characterise his general sort of performance as rather under par?
He's not very strategic, and that's something that you can see with this handling of the Geneva invitations. It would have been possible to take a stronger line to say the UN insists that we invite all of these people, but the kind of rapid changes, the hopes that a private assurance would count instead of a public assurance and so on, weren't very effective. Mind you, in that clip, I think it's Walid Mualem who comes off as rather the worse. And I think it is a reminder that while the regime speakers can sound quite polished, they do come from an authoritarian system where simply the idea of having somebody interrupt you is unthinkable.
Just a little bit. We shouldn't really laugh, but it was rather funny in some respects. We're going to take a very short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Have no fear. Jane Kinnamont and Raffaello Pantucci will still be here when we return. Don't go away.
24/7, 28 programmes, up to 10 hours of speech a day. There's a glorious feast of Monocle 24 to savour. But when you want a slimming digest, fear not, we've got the curator. Premiering every Saturday and downloadable via monocle.com and at iTunes, it's a weekly roundup of the best from the week that was. Hours of audio output distilled into 1 hour of selected interviews, quirky dispatches and journalistic coups. Plus, here again, from the entrepreneurs, urbanists, architects, artists and culinary masterminds who made Monocle 24 special over the past 7 days. That's The Curator here on Monocle 24, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Jane Kinnamont from Chatham House and Raffaello Pantucci from RUSI are both still with me. Let's turn to Davos next. The World Economic Forum holding its annual meeting, of course. We'll be hearing a little later in the programme from Bloomberg's Matthew Campbell, who's there with all the latest news. I'd just like to get your take on, I guess, events like this, but specifically with the World Economic Forum, Raffaello, what do you sort of approach this period in the calendar with a sense of trepidation? Or do you always look forward to seeing, you know, what people are going to say, what the main themes are going to be?
I'll be honest, I sort of look at this with very little particular attention. It strikes me, it comes around every year. These leaders go there. I know I have had senior bosses I used to work for who sort of have to go to Davos. And frankly, when they report back, they tell me these great stories about having wonderful dinners and getting to meet such and such and who. Mm-hmm. And great, I'm very jealous of them. But it sounds like it was kind of a bit of a fandango. I mean, I don't know, maybe I'm being desperately cynical here and a lot is being achieved there behind the scenes that I'm not seeing. But to me, it seems like a sort of big annual gathering of the sort of great and the wonderful plutocrats to talk about the great issues of the day, I suppose.
Absolutely. We can be desperately cynical. That's perfectly all right. Jane, what about when somebody like, for example, Iran's President Hassan Rouhani rocks up at Davos? Does that change the tenor of it for you? Or do you share any of Raffaello's, what should we say, mild cynicism about it?
Well, it's fascinating that Rouhani wanted to go and that he's trying to pitch what has originally been intended as a revolutionary republic, as a country that is acceptable rubbing shoulders with the presidents and bankers at Davos. It's very much a signal, you know, we're just normal and we want to be part of the world community and do business with you.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, Raffaello, what do you think about that? Is it a demonstration of, you know, his more moderate outlook on things, or is it just a great opportunity to cozy up to some of these oil execs that you were alluding to over martinis or not, perhaps, well, one evening? What do you think? What's his real objective?
Well, I think it's, you know, there's clearly, since Rouhani's come in, he's come in and he's pretty much laid out quite a clear sense that he sees, you know, that Iran needs to have a new place in the world, and that the place that Ahmadinejad pushed them into was a corner which was not doing them any good. And so for him to come out like this and to come to this sort of event, I think Jane's 100% right. It is fascinating. You see, you know, a revolutionary leader like this, in theory, to sort of show up at such an event. But then couldn't the same be said about China? You know, the sort of Chinese leadership, already, this is a communist government, you know, who sort of shows up there in big numbers now as well and sort of, you know, attend in being everything from their state-owned enterprises over to their officials. So I think it's an interesting combination from that perspective. I think that Rouhani is clearly trying to take advantage of the opening that we did start to see. I think his country has clearly been wrecked economically by the sanctions over the past few years, and they really need outside investment. I've seen a number of presentations around the world by some of the Invest in Iran folk, and it's very clear that there's absolute desperation, and they're really eager for anyone to come and bring them technology, investment. And so I could see why this would be the sort of perfect opportunity for him to show up, to take advantage of the fact that you have got this opening, to start to show up, to start to build those connections, which maybe can be transformed into some sort of investment. If at an event like this, he can make enough connections with some of the sort of business leadership, they will, of course, also see this opportunity and will in turn try to lobby their governments to try to continue this opening up. So I see it's a very sort of canny political move from his perspective.
It's interesting, Jane. Do you think that there is, people will certainly, you know, in the West, for example, and business leaders maybe sniffing an opportunity, will be convinced enough by that kind of display of political and economic pragmatism to actually, you know, listen a bit more intently and maybe take a few risks and maybe get more involved?
Iran's a very interesting country for businesses. Mm. Obviously, you've got the oil, which is really underperforming because there's been so little investment. But also, it's a country of over 70 million people. Mm-hmm. So in terms of the population, it's bigger than any of the Arab countries except for Egypt, and it's wealthier than Egypt. So just as a market, it's incredibly interesting. And there's a huge appetite for Western brands, European goods, etc., etc. So I think businesses, often they're not so interested in the politics. They're not doing business now in many cases because of the sanctions and the financial sanctions. But as soon as they see the sanctions easing, as soon as they start seeing other businesses going in, there will be a rush to get back into Iran. Mm.
It's amazing what that view of the bottom line can do.
Absolutely.
For people, isn't it? Let's talk. You mentioned Egypt there briefly, Jane. Let's talk about Egypt a little. The country's interim PM has backed military leader al-Sisi. I just wonder, I mean, perhaps there's nothing surprising about this, Raffaello. I mean, is this the question of someone who's, you know, the only real contender, you know, the only person who has popular support? I mean, Jane, what do you make of it?
He's certainly the best known contender if he chooses to stand. He's far better known than the interim president, Adli Mansour. It's interesting that you see the Prime Minister, Beblawi, speaking up in favour of him. At the same time, Beblawi's deputy, who's another very respected economist, Ziad Bahauddin, is trying to resign at the moment. So there's certainly not total support. But you are seeing an increasingly widespread media campaign sort of likening Sisi to Nasser. Sisi spoke to one of the local papers last year and apparently said that former President Sadat had appeared to him in a dream and told him that he would be the president of Egypt.
That's pretty compelling, isn't it?
So, you know, who are we to argue with Sadat's ghost?
I mean, it's interesting. Again, we're talking about sort of political pragmatism throughout this, really. And obviously, the prospect of some stability somewhere does seem to work. You know, the stock markets have hit a fresh high in the country. Do you think we'll see an outbreak of sensible behaviour, a bit of pragmatism from the political classes, from everyone across the board in Egypt, just a desire to actually make some progress, to try and, you know, boost the economy and not get too bound up in the ongoing disagreements?
I wish I could say yes. I mean, I think there is, there's been some economic relief because of the aid that's come in, $12 billion from the different Gulf countries. But so far, the political process isn't pointing towards reconciliation. The way that the referendum and the constitution was handled indicated that 98% of those who voted yes. But the only party that was campaigning for a no vote found that its campaigners were arrested on the eve of the vote. All the other opponents boycotted. So you have now a constitution that was pushed through in a very divisive way. You've got the Brotherhood now outlawed as a terrorist organisation, and yet this is a party with very substantial support. The path of the transition seems likely to remain very, very polarised.
Well, sort of slightly bleak message to end on.
But, I'm sorry.
It's very difficult. It's very difficult sometimes to delve into some of these issues without coming to that conclusion. And on that point, we will leave it a little downbeat, but measured perhaps.
Next time we'll talk about happy places.
Yes. Absolutely, Jane Kinnaman taking us to a happy place next time. That's going to be worth tuning in for. That is Jane Kinnaman from Chatham House, Raffaello Pantucci from the Royal United Services Institute. Thank you both very much for joining me here on Midori House.
Thank you.
Vanuit Londen. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
It is Monocle 24. You're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Plenty still ahead in the second half of today's programme. We'll be back to Davos as well to talk to Matthew Campbell. We'll also be reviewing the latest literature from our man in the Eastern Med. Before all of that, though, with the time at 32 minutes past the hour here in London, let's hear from David Spencer, who's here with the latest world news headlines.
Thank you very much indeed, Tom. South Sudan's government and rebel troops have signed a ceasefire. It's hoped the deal will end fighting that has lasted more than a month and killed thousands of people in the world's newest nation. Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych is holding talks with opposition leaders as violence spreads across Ukraine. Anti-government demonstrations in the capital Kiev have now spread to other cities. At least 15 people have been killed during violence in Central African Republic's capital Bangui. The head of the local Red Cross said the death toll is likely to rise. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani has addressed delegates at the World Economic Forum in Switzerland. The Davos speech was much anticipated, and he struck an upbeat tone, declaring that Iran could become one of the world's top 10 economies. At least 3 people have died and 30 are missing after a fire ripped through an old people's home in Quebec. Police say 9 people have been taken to hospital after being rescued from the 3-story building. In the United States, a federal privacy watchdog has said the National Security Agency's bulk collection of phone records provides only minimal benefits to countering terrorism, is illegal, and it should end. The Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board is an independent government agency that advises the President and Congress on how to ensure that counter-terrorism operations also protect Americans' privacy. Those are latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank Thank you very much indeed, David. More news, of course, for you at the top of the hour. David will be back with a full bulletin at 1900 hours. You're with Midori House, live here on Monocle 24. It's 21:34 in Moscow and 16:34 in Rio. It's time to check in with one of Monocle's correspondents around the world. Now, we're heading to Bogota. Our correspondent, Anastasia Maloney, is armed and ready with the week's top stories. Anastasia, welcome to the programme. Great to have you with us, as always. Talk to us about a presidential campaign. Everybody loves a bit of politics. When does the campaign get underway?
The presidential elections get underway really this weekend when the candidates kick off their election campaigns. And the current president, Juan Manuel Santos, he's gearing up for re-election. And he's actually leading the polls at the moment. And if it continues, it's likely that he'll get re-elected when Colombians choose their next president in May.
And tell me, Anastasia, it's interesting, isn't it, that he's suggested he's pretty optimistic about a peace deal, of course, dealing with the FARC rebels. Do you think that that will be, once again, sort of the key issue politically? And whether anyone else tries to take the agenda anywhere else, it's always going to come back to that ongoing peace process?
I think you're right. I think definitely, particularly this time, as there are ongoing peace talks between the FARC guerrilla group and the government in Havana at the moment, the whole election campaign will be based around the peace process. Certainly Santos, the president at the moment, he's campaigning on a platform of peace. He's selling himself as the man who can bring peace to Colombia after 50 years of war, and he's cautiously optimistic that some sort of a peace deal will be signed by the end of the year. He said it's very unlikely it'll be signed by May when the elections happen, but he's hopeful that the two sides can come to an agreement this year.
Now, one of the issues that they're going to be discussing, I guess the Havana talks in particular featuring this, is the issue of drugs, of course. The Colombian government, the US government, agree with them, suggesting that FARC are key players in the sort of cocaine trade. FARC rebels suggest that that's not the case. But this is going to be one of the key sort of tranches of discussion, isn't it, that they're going to have to thrash out?
That's right. They've been talking now for over 14 months in Havana, and they've already agreed on two points. One is land reform, and the other one is the FARC's political future, their participation in Colombian politics. And now, as you say, they're talking about drugs, the cocaine trade, and the FARC's role in cocaine production. And this is one of the thorniest issues because, as you've mentioned, the Colombian government does say that the FARC has a big stake in this trade. So they'll be sitting down trying to organize what will happen with those drug trafficking routes. And for the FARC, they're very interested to see what will happen to the farmers who grow coca, which is the raw ingredient for cocaine. What's going to happen to them, and how is the government going to help them exchange coca for food crops?
And as I said, we often see, don't we, that a lot of the conflict and the military focus is often sort of crosses over the same areas where these crops are grown. I guess it's perhaps not that surprising, but presumably that'll be one strand that FARC, perhaps in particular, might have something to say about.
That's right. Where coca is grown in Colombia is often where the FARC is concentrated. It's often in their strongholds and where the conflict continues. And so what happens in those areas definitely does affect the FARC and their support and the power that they have. So they will be wanting guarantees from the government that people there will actually have some sort of livelihood and development projects and infrastructure in place if they do sign a peace deal.
Anastasia, let's talk a little bit more about politics sort of on your beat, if you will. Bogota's mayor, we don't know whether he's going to stay or go. Just in brief, sort of remind us why Gustavo Petro is in limbo.
Yeah, this has been going on for weeks, and it's really uncertain what his future is. It goes back to a ruling by by Colombia's Inspector General, and he ruled that Gustavo Petro, the mayor, had mismanaged the rubbish collection in Bogota. And for that reason, he was sacked from his job for 15 years. That means he's barred from holding any kind of political office for the next 15 years. This created a huge protest in the street. Supporters of Petro came out into the streets, and they've been doing that almost every Friday since the decision last December. And there's been appeals and counter-appeals. And the latest news is that a court in Colombia ruled that the decision actually was incorrect and it violated his rights, and so suspended temporarily the order to sack him. So we're still waiting to see who has the final say. It looks like the president himself will have the final say, and it looks very likely that at the end of this month he will have to sign a paper giving the go-ahead or not for his sacking. So it's still very uncertain. Petro is still kind of the mayor, but every day his situation changes, and he's also got an appeal process going on with the Inter-American Court of Human Rights as well.
So he's got his work cut out for him. And it's all about rubbish. Rubbish and mayor, two words that often get put together in this city where I'm sitting right now, Anastasia. Thank you very much for joining us on the programme. That was Anastasia Maloney, Monocle's correspondent in Bogota. We're off to Davos next on Midori House. Stay tuned here on Monocle 24.
Monocle has shops around the world selling our exclusive collaborations with some of our favourite designers, including Ettinger, Porter, Barena, Jawbone, Oliver Peoples, and many more. You can find us on College Street in Toronto, Hudson and Charles in New York, and in the heart of Wan Chai in Hong Kong, and two in London. So, whether you're after a versatile travelling wardrobe, something for the home, or a present for a loved one, or just missing back issues from your collection, you're sure to find something at the Monocle shop.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Time for another check-in with our contributors at the World Economic Forum in Davos, the Alpine Retreat, for the global 1% that so failed to impress Raffaella Pantucci a little earlier. On Monocle 24 all week, we've been getting the latest news, bit of gossip, and all the developments from Bloomberg's editors and correspondents a little earlier. I caught up with one of their number, Matthew Campbell, a reporter for Bloomberg News here in London. Matthew covers the deals and big business stories in Europe for Bloomberg. And we began by talking about one of the hot button issues at Davos, immigration.
There has been some discussion about that. There was a panel today involving some business and political leaders on the subject of immigration that expressed quite a bit of concern about the tenor of the debate around that subject, both in Europe, in North America, and elsewhere, presented, of course, as something bad, something to be minimized or mitigated rather than as a benefit to economies. And here in Davos, of course, that has particular relevance. The concept of the Davos man, which has become a bit of a joke, but is a real thing, coined by a Harvard professor, Samuel Huntington, is of this borderless business person who can move easily around the globe. But actually, even for highly skilled people, that's becoming very difficult. In the last year, we've seen much tougher immigration rules in the United Kingdom, in Singapore, which is, of course, traditionally very open to this sort of thing. So that is something that you do hear here, a little bit of concern that this very basic component of international business, of international thought, that people can live and work more or less where they wish, particularly highly skilled people, could be under threat.
Matthew, tell me, is there any sense there of why there is this sort of disconnect then between government's attitudes towards legal immigration and how they're trying to crack down on it and the threats to business? Because it doesn't seem to join up very well, does it?
Well, there's obviously an element of populism, certainly in the UK. As you know, there is a great deal of popular interest in immigration. It's something that is on the front page of the tabloids virtually every day. Of course, we're also coming out in North America and Europe of a very severe recession. And it is natural in those circumstances that you would see countries beginning to say, you know what, we don't want any foreigners coming in, we want to keep jobs for locals. But as economies grow, businesses need people to come in from abroad. That's particularly true in Europe, where the birth rate is very low. Even if we doubled the birth rate tomorrow in European countries, those people wouldn't be entering the workforce for 20 years at least. So there is a need for these people to come in. That's what we hear from business leaders, but they don't feel they're getting a hearing from governments necessarily.
Matthew, all that talk makes me feel a little stressed out, and I gather that stress has been another one of the big themes at the World Economic Forum. Tell us exactly why.
Well, there is a real focus here on stress, on wellness, mental health in particular they are trying to address. There is a sense that you do get from the organizers of the World Economic Forum, and in fact they're quite explicit about it, that these issues have been somewhat underplayed. And as a result, we have this week actually Goldie Hawn, the star of many films you probably know, Shampoo from the 70s being the most famous, doing seminars on how to meditate. There are Buddhist monks milling about the Congress Center, also teaching people how to meditate, how to be a bit more centered, a bit more calm. And actually, this is not quite as loopy to a business crowd as you might think. There are plenty of people on Wall Street who say they meditate once or twice a day, lots of people in finance who swear by it. So there is a bit of an effort there. I think part of it has to do with anxiety over the impact of technology. We're all being beeped and buzzed at by our smartphones all day. And there is a real interest among the attendees here in figuring out how to unplug, so to speak, and meditation and other forms of stress relief seem to be figuring into that.
I think a lot of people need a bit of a lesson in wellness, I guess, at the World Economic Forum, like everywhere else. Matthew, let me ask you about something a little bit different. Disruptive technology. Now, again, this might be something that perhaps people weren't expecting to be on the agenda, but perhaps they should have done.
Well, it was on the agenda in a Bloomberg television panel that we did today with some technology executives and also the incoming chief executive officer of Walmart. This is a real subject for big business because what you had about 10 years ago was, it was obvious in the early days of the internet who was in trouble. It was travel agencies to a certain extent who could be displaced by cheaper online alternatives. Newspapers, we know that story very well. Record labels. But actually now the portion of the economy that is prone to these sorts of disruption is expanding. We've seen this year Walmart, or in the last year I should say, Walmart, which is a very dominant retailer in the United States, stumble a bit due to competition from Amazon. Intel, of course, the world's largest maker of semiconductors, has had some problems as a result of not being able to compete in mobile devices to the extent they would like, and there are more nimble competitors. Siemens, the German engineering conglomerate, has all kinds of upstart competitors nibbling away at its businesses. This is something that business leaders are nervous about, and they're trying to get an edge and figure out how they can stay ahead of the technological curve, which, as we've seen, is a very, very difficult proposition for big, slow-moving corporations.
I just wonder, Matthew, finally on this point, I mean, do you think there's a sense that this is a kind of a generational problem, and it won't actually be until maybe the real new crop of sort of industry leaders of tomorrow actually get really senior in these companies that they'll embrace the kind of pace of change they need to keep nimble and to keep showing the dexterity required to respond to these challenges?
Well, I think that's an excellent question. There are certainly no digital natives yet running Fortune 500 companies. Anyone who grew up with Facebook and YouTube is much too young for that. But over the next 10, 20, 25 years, obviously that's going to start happening, and that may be what it takes. But in the interim, you could have a lot of once quite dominant companies get into real trouble if they don't figure out when the technology has turned or when their market has changed or been disrupted. And that's what people are worried about here.
That was Bloomberg's Matthew Campbell talking to me a little earlier from Davos. It's to Switzerland we go next on Midori House, a land perhaps not best known for its engineering and architectural feats, but that would be incorrect. The troops of technical engineers that were deployed all around the country to develop its railways, Switzerland's built on that and maintained its technical know-how to become one of the world's leaders. Nowhere was this more apparent than at Swissbau this week in Basel, a trade fair for real estate and construction, showcasing thousands of exhibitors from all across the nation. Monocle's Alexa Firmanich went along to Swissbau to meet Sascha Mentz, the former dean of Zurich's Federal Institute of Technology and the founder of one of its newest entities, the Institute of Technology in Architecture. Under the bridge of the towering Messe Exhibition Centre, Mentz talked about the ITA's plans for a new innovative teaching centre at the heart of the campus.
What you see here is our university campus. ETH in Zurich at the Hanke Berg is our second campus, a bit outside of downtown. And our institute, the Institute of Technology and Architecture, decided to build its own building. We have basically all disciplines. We are architects, we are engineers, we are physics, we are specialists in building. So all major disciplines you need to plan and to build a building are present at this institute. And so with that, we put all our skills together with joint forces. We go on and we persuade our president of the ETH and tell him that we're going to build our own building. The idea of the building is an interesting one. The building is built on an existing structure. So what you see here in the also in the movie, you see an existing parking garage. So there's an existing building, and we said we don't take a virgin plot where grass is and soil is, but we take a plot where mankind has built, and that means that we are densifying the plot. So this could be a model for future city densification with superstructures on it. So that's basically how we started. And we said we connect the building to the existing campus with a bridge system, and also you can walk through the building and just reach to new land and to maybe new buildings.
So this part would be the new part.
This would be the new part. So this will be our institute. Okay. So when you look at the structure of the building, I take away now this roof structure. We said one skill is we built on an existing structure. If you do that, you have to build light. And what you have to do is you don't have to vulnerate too much the existing in the underground. So what we said is 2, 4, 6 per 2 is 12 stilts, double stilts, penetrate the existing structure of a parking garage, holding up the new building. So there will be no cores, which usually cores hold up a building, give them stability, but the cores with elevators, with ducts, with staircases, they obstruct an open plan. And what we said, we want to have an open plan which can be changed in the future. The second thing is that we are 10 professorships with at least everyone a team of around 15 people, which is like the ground staff. And then you have PhD students and other students. Finally, 350 people could be in this building. The idea of the building is on the first huge level, 8 meters high, will be a robotics laboratory. So we experiment with roboters, with these robots, and these robots will be hung on the ceiling, not on the ground. So the ground is completely free, and the robots will assemble in a way with new technologies and show us how the future will be built. The robots will also build the roof of this building.
The robots will build the roof.
Yeah, it won't be, unfortunately, these robots. That would be even the nicer story. You have the robots and they build their own roof, but this is at the moment not possible. But what we do is the robots in a factory will build the roof out of small pieces of wood. The maximum length of a piece of wood would be 1.60 meters, so it can be a third class wood, it can be a recycled wood, it's just not the best wood. The roof will be on the second floor of the building, which will be also a double height space, where half of the space is double height and the other part of the space will be with filled in with galleries. And on top of the galleries, there won't be a closed office. It's a complete open structure where PhD students can meet, work together. So the idea of an open workspace. In the middle, we imagine a huge piazza. Under the galleries will be all the professorships. Everyone will have his little structure where he also have the closed doors. We need that for exam questions, for privacy questions, of course. But the basic idea is you walk into the space, you feature the whole space, you can imagine, you can see, you can feel the space, and people meet. So we say we are professors, we are researchers, we are teachers, we are people who want to proceed in working together. It's not the old idea of the professor in his little cabinet with a closed door, with the spectacles on and reading his book and writing his text, and you never know what happens at the end. But we sense teamwork. Teamwork for us will be the future, because also for the whole building industry and planning process, teamwork is the magic word.
That was Sascha Mentz, founder of the Institute of Technology in Architecture in Basel, with our own Alexa Firmanich. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We're fast approaching the end of the programme.
but as promised, it's time for our daily review. We like to leaf through the very best in books, visit the theatre, take in some art, listen to some music, head to the cinema. With our correspondents and contributors all around the world, it is books that we're leafing through today. That's why we're heading to Istanbul to be joined live by Monocle's Eastern Mediterranean correspondent, Joseph Dana. Joseph, welcome to the programme. Good to have you with us, as always. Let's start, perhaps, with a bit of Viennese romance.
Yes, let's do that. It's a very interesting tale, this book. Effectively, so we have a Hebrew writer that was born in Russia, that lived in Vienna and Paris in the 1920s, actually moved to Palestine, to Tel Aviv, at the invitation of a prestigious Hebrew language academy there, but moved back to Europe and actually was killed by the Nazis in the Holocaust. And he single-handedly transformed the Hebrew language. As we've heard before, you know, Hebrew was a kind of dead language that was resurrected by the Israeli state. But here was a writer that was basically European, that transformed this language and left a very interesting, somewhat controversial canon behind. And in his journals, which he left many of, he kind of talked about the fact that he was working on a novel, but no one could ever find this novel until 2010, when a young Israeli researcher was sitting in the bowels of one of these Hebrew language archives in Tel Aviv and came across a manuscript that she thought was Fogel's novel called Facing the Sea, which is a kind of love tale about two lovers in the French Riviera. But there was these very vivid descriptions of life in Vienna, and so she kind of looked around, and then she realized that she had actually found this unpublished novel of David Fogel, almost as if he was writing from the grave. I mean, he had been dead for nearly 70 years at that point. And so this month, a British publication house is publishing an English language translation of this novel, Viennese Romance. And like I said, it's just a fantastic story of a dead and well-liked author that has left something that's been found, and as if he's writing from the grave itself.
Absolutely. I just wondered, what's the view then of David Fogel? Because it's interesting, when these manuscripts are uncovered, I wonder what his sort of reputation is. Do you think this will enhance it, or will it perhaps help him to reach a new audience, perhaps, certainly in Israel?
That's an excellent question. Like I said, he had this kind of ambivalent stance towards Zionism. I mean, he was at his core a European writer who was writing in Hebrew because that was the language he understood the best. And he went to Palestine, but he left. He did not necessarily subscribe to what was going on in Israel. And so that presented a real challenge for some of the Israeli literary elites. He's been kind of downcast a little bit when it comes to his great contributions to the Hebrew language. And this novel has recast that debate. It's an excellent novel. I would definitely recommend anyone to read it. It's a great romance story of a kind of young writer living in Vienna, trying to get by. And these excellent kind of episodes of what turn of the century Vienna looked like. And, you know, it's caused quite a debate in the Israeli press, and there's been a number of calls to kind of, you know, bring David Fogel back into the canon of the Hebrew language that he belongs to.
Well, let's see how the English translation helps that happen. Joseph, just very briefly, before we end the show, I want to ask you in short about a new book about President Truman, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, looking back at some of the origins. Just tell us in short, what angle does this take, and does it shed any new light, perhaps, on this old question?
Well, it's a very good book. It's written by a senior editor at the New Republic, and effectively, President Truman has always been looked at as one of the most pro-Israel of American presidents. And this book basically calls that into question, arguing that President Truman actually had very progressive ideas about how the Israeli-Palestinian conflict should be ended, specifically whether or not Israel should be a one state with the Palestinians. Now, with John Kerry trying to fight for this peace process, the publication of this book is going to be extremely controversial, and it's going to recast that American-Israeli relationship, and it will be very interesting to see how it plays out in both the Israeli press and in the United States.
Absolutely. We'll watch that reaction very carefully. Joseph Dana, talking about John Judas's book about President Truman. Thank you very much indeed for joining us, our Eastern Med correspondent on the line from Istanbul. That's all we have time for, I'm sorry to say, on today's Midori House. A special thanks in particular to Jane Kinnamont and Raffaello Pantucci, my guests today. The programme was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Maddie Arouge, and our studio manager was Bill Luti. Up next is The Urbanist with David Michon. It's all about the kids this week. Be sure to stay tuned for that at 2200 hours here in London, of course. The Monocle Daily with Emma and Andrew is coming your way. This show will be back at the same time, 1800 hours London time tomorrow, in case you needed reminding. But for this edition of the show, that is all. Have a great day.
It tells the story of a passion for motor racing, a legend forged over time by the pioneers of speed and great drivers. The Daytona Cosmograph, the watch made to break barriers, the watch dedicated to endurance, the watch that was born to race. Rolex.